In 1896, the British Museum acquired a clay tablet from an area of the Middle East that would be roughly 94 kilometers south of the city of Baghdad in Iraq. Beverly and I saw this 2,600-year-old tablet when we visited the British Museum last October. It reads as follows. The seventh year in the month Kislev, the king of Akkad, who we know as Nebuchadnezzar, mustered his army and encamped against the city of Judah, and on the second day of the month Adar, he captured the city and seized its king. A king of his own choice he appointed in the city, and taking the vast tribute, he brought it to Bavelim, which in the Akkadian language means gate of the gods, and in Greek the word is translated Babylon. This very brief document found among the Babylonian government records attests to and corroborates the biblical accounts of the capture and deportation of the Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 586 BCE. In the book of 2 Kings 25, verses 1 to 6, it describes the same fateful events from the Jewish perspective. It reads, "So in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the tenth day of the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. He, that is Nebuchadnezzar, encamped outside the city and built siege works all around it." I'm sure you're familiar with what a siege is, but basically, if an army is gathered and hiding behind a city wall, a stronghold, a fortified place, then the army camps around the city and blocks off any chance for those people to bring in food or get fresh supplies. The city was kept under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah, and by the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine in the city had become so severe that there was no food for the people to eat. Then the city wall was broken through, and the whole army fled at night through the gate between the two walls near the king's garden, though the Babylonians were surrounding the city. They fled towards Arabah, but the Babylonian army pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. And all his soldiers were separated from him and scattered, and he was captured. The Hebrew word eko is a question. And it means something like, how? As in, how could our God desert us, his chosen people? How could Yahweh permit those heathens to destroy and defile the holy city Jerusalem and its temple? In English, the word echo is lamentation. And the five poems that make up the biblical book of Lamentations were likely written a little more than 500 years before the time of Jesus by Judeans who remained in the land after Babylon took most of the population into captivity. And the Book of Lamentations has as its backdrop the stark reality that Judah and the Jewish religious system was finished. But why? How could this have happened? During this time, Judah's capital city, Jerusalem, was brought to rubble. The temple and its sacred treasures were ransacked. The sacrifices and temple rituals came to an abrupt end. But by far the most significant crisis for the Jewish people was that the Davidic monarchy, which was prophesied to bear a future Messiah, which was prophesied to never end, ended. Why? Why did Babylon's crown prince, Nebuchadnezzar II, even bother with such a tiny little kingdom as Judah? Well, the simplified historical answer is that Judah was strategically trapped between two great closely matched warring superpowers, Babylon to the east and Egypt to the southwest. Judah was, in a sense, a buffer state, and both Babylon and Egypt needed to use Judah as a staging ground for attacks on the other. So Judah was forced to choose sides, and they switched sides based upon whom they thought could protect them from the other at any given time. And just a few years earlier, Babylon had tried in vain to conquer Egypt. They won a major battle at Carchemish in 605 and defeated Pharaoh Necho, but they were unable to capture the whole nation. And just a few years before that, Pharaoh Necho had set up Eliakim as king of Judah, and he changed Eliakim's name from Eliakim to Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim means he whom Yahweh has set up. Notice that very, very carefully. Egypt's Pharaoh set up a king in Judah and changed his name to a name that meant God has set him up. This is called marketing spin, and churches do it all the time. They decide to do something, and then they claim that God led them to do it, or it's blessed by God, or driven by God. And it's misusing the authority of God to validate and give a greater level of credibility to what you've decided to do. And you hope that this will have significance to the people who then believe that, yes, it must be God's will or God's work. So obviously, Jehoiakim was pro-Egypt, even though he had to pay a very hefty tribute for their protection. But after the Egyptian defeat in Carchemish, Jehoiakim changed sides and started paying the tribute to Babylon to avoid the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. A few years later, the Babylonians led another inconclusive attack on Egypt, and Jehoiakim switched sides back to the Egyptians. And Nebuchadnezzar had had enough. He attacked Jerusalem, and Jehoiakim died in the siege. His son Jeconiah succeeded his father for only 3 months before Nebuchadnezzar deposed him and installed Zedekiah at age 21 as the new king of Judah. It's like a soap opera, isn't it? Zedekiah's loyalty to Babylon didn't last long. He figured he had a better chance with the Egyptian pharaoh Hophra. And in response, Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem again, and when he finally broke through the city walls, as we read in 2 Kings, he made Zedekiah watch while he killed his sons and then put Zedekiah's eyes out, blinding him, took him prisoner to Babylon where he died. So on the one hand, you have this complex and intense political and military maneuvering taking place. But it's really important to remember that in the ancient world, religion and politics and even warfare were not separate entities. So the invasion of Judah by Babylon, even though it was strategically because they were stuck between Egypt and Babylon, Judah had to come to terms with the theological explanation for why this had happened. And that is the backdrop for the book of Lamentations. For its authors, God was using Nebuchadnezzar to punish Judah. That's the basic explanation. But why? Why had Yahweh deserted his people? Why did God allow the holy temple to be ransacked? How could the line of Davidic kings be ended? And was there any future for the Jews as a people and as a religion? The tone of Lamentations is bleak. When you read the book from beginning to end, the five poems, at no time does God speak. He is silent, which reflects their view that God had deserted them. He was far from them. The degree of suffering is presented as a little over the top, frankly, kind of undeserved, and expectations of future redemption are minimal. As far as they're concerned, it's over. You may be familiar with the song, "By the Waters of Babylon, There We Wept and Sat Down." In fact, the prophet Jeremiah at this time said, look, don't even try to think about getting out of this. Just settle in, marry the local women, take jobs with the Babylonians, build houses, settle in. You will be born and die in this land. But if you take the words of the prophets as a whole, including the last prophet, Jesus, we see beyond the pain and the torment to recognize that what seems like the desertion of the children of God by their God was very much deserved for one repeated, consistent reason. They, that is, the people of God at any given time, had long since deserted God in their hearts, and this is the important part, while maintaining a vibrant and vigorous and extensive system of external and superficial worship and religious tradition. It looked like a very active religion. Very busy, very vibrant, but they had, in fact, deserted God in their hearts. And it is that false alternative, the external, the institutionalized religion, which suffocates and suppresses true spiritual worship of God, that I want to examine more closely. Let me just read a few passages from Lamentations to give you a kind of a taste, a little sense of the futility and hopelessness of the authors. Remember, this is poetry that expresses the confusion about why God would do this to us, his people, and the turmoil of a people who believed they had been abandoned by their God. This is very shortly after those who remained had watched their loved ones be slaughtered in the streets, their city destroyed, their way of life gone forever, their sacrifices ended, their priests slaughtered, their king dead, and most of the rest of the people that they had ever known marched off in shackles to another country, never to come back. This is one of the poems, the first one. How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. She who was queen among the provinces has now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night, tears are on her cheeks. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. And the Lord has brought her grief because of her many sins. Her children have gone into exile, captive before the foe. In the days of her affliction and wandering, Jerusalem remembers all the treasures that were hers in the days of old. Jerusalem has sinned greatly, and so has become unclean. Her fall was astounding, and there was not one to comfort her. Is any suffering like my suffering that was inflicted on me, that the Lord brought on me in the day of his fierce anger? From on high he sent fire, sent it down into my bones. And he spread a net for my feet and turned me back. He made me desolate and faint all the day long. My sins have been bound into a yoke, and by his hands they were woven together. They have been hung on my neck, and the Lord has sucked out my strength. He has given me into the hands of those I cannot withstand. And so goes the rest of the book. So goes the other four poems of utter bleak helplessness. The author is acknowledging that Judah has sinned catastrophically and that punishment was fair and deserved, but maybe not this much. Not a total end to who we are as a people and a religion. But from God's perspective, there was no alternative. There was no hope of changing these people. He had tried and tried and tried, and there was no chance that Judah was going to change. Why? We've got to keep asking why through this book of whys. Because the spiritual rot was too deep. The rot, like their religion, like much of our religion, had become politicized, militarized, and institutionalized. It had begun with and been fostered by the leaders, their prophets and priests, who were greedy, who were in it for selfish gain, who were in it for power and control. And now, like a virus, it had contaminated Judah's whole culture and worship experience. The prophet Jeremiah expresses on behalf of God the frustration he has with the religious leaders of Judah. I'm reading this from the Message from Jeremiah 23. This is, in a sense, God speaking as if it were he talking, but through Jeremiah. I never sent these prophets, but they ran anyway, as if I had sent them. I never spoke to them, but they preached anyway, as if they preached by my authority on my behalf with my blessing and my message. This is a timeless warning that Jeremiah is giving. This is not for one period in Judah's history. This had been a message that the prophets had brought over and over and over and over again to Judah. You will see echoes of this in Jesus' criticism of the religious leaders of his day. And why would we think that suddenly all of this natural tendency for corruption within religion would end in the year 1100 or the year 1825 or 2018? There's something about religion that produces this. He says, I never spoke to them, but they preached anyway, as if I had. If they'd have even bothered to sit down and meet with me, they'd have preached my message to my people. But they didn't. I know what they're saying. All these prophets who preach lies use me as their text, saying, I had this dream, or God spoke to me and said, how long do I have to put up with this? Do these prophets give 2 cents about me as they preach their lies and spew out their grandiose delusions? I've had it with these prophets who get their sermons secondhand from each other. Yes, I've had it with them. They make up stuff and then pretend it's a real sermon. In other words, they haven't even really thought about what they're saying. They just say what's popular. They say what's easy. He says, I never sent these prophets. I never authorized a single one of them. Instead of claiming to know what God says, ask questions of one another, such as, how do we, the community of faith, understand God in this? He's saying, why have you looked to these crooked leaders for the answers? When I speak to you, when you come together in community, I am there among you where 2 or 3 are gathered. You together collectively, all of you, are the revealers of truth, as each one has a little and comes together. But don't go around pretending to know it all, saying, God told me this, and God told me that. In the Edge Fellowship, we've used phrases like Christianity without religion, or Jesus without religion. And those are worthwhile goals. But in reality, that's a little too black and white. Things are a little more complex than that. Because religion per se is not the problem. It's what people do with religion on both sides. Jesus pointed out in Matthew's Gospel that there is fault on the side of those who seek to use religion to control people. And then there are people who believe the lie that God actually only speaks through those often sincere and well-intentioned leaders, and they detach themselves from the responsibility, the personal responsibility, to think and to analyze and to challenge. and to share their truth, what the Spirit has revealed to them. And the sad thing is that religion, in its simplest and purest form, is as inherently part of our human nature as eating and breathing. But religion so very easily becomes corrupted when it moves beyond personal responsibility to corporate responsibility. That's what's wrong. To be a spiritual leader confers a range of real advantages and benefits for one within a community who can claim to have the insight into the world beyond. Ancient societies, including ancient Israel, have always highly revered the holy man, the shaman, the seer, the prophet, and the priest. So when these exalted individuals within a community are corrupt, insincere, and ego-driven, the religion they promote as the voice of God obviously is also corrupt. And that's what happened in Judah. And that's why they went into Babylonian captivity. So what is it that God didn't like about the religion of Jeremiah's day? And can we find any parallels in the religion of Christianity throughout the centuries? And why are we not asking these questions? Why is the church not continually evaluating itself, continually challenging itself? We preach sermons on each person needs to examine their own hearts, that individually we need to look deep and see where there might be leaven. Why does the church as a whole not say it is the natural tendency for religion to become corrupt? That is the natural state. It's not automatic, and there are many cases where it is not corrupt. But if that's the default state, then why as a church do we not continually evaluate whether or not we are guilty of any of those things that the people in the time of Jeremiah were also guilty of? So before we answer that, before we look exactly at what was wrong specifically with the religion of Jeremiah's day, I want to acknowledge the benefits of a formal spiritual community and organized worship. A formal spiritual community does not need to be institutionalized. In fact, it should not be. But if we just limit our discussion to Christianity, what benefit does the spiritual community that forms around the teachings of Jesus, that worships together, that learns together, that encourages one another in mutual respect and love, what benefit do we bring to the world? And as shocking as it may sound, we'll begin next week by noting what is so good about religion.